You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I think the publication of this book is a significant event in the discussion of accountability for mass atrocities. I'm not aware of a comparable effort to examine the actual impact of this kind of accountability mechanism on the countries which have been the focus of its work. And Diane is a scholar, but also a participant in efforts to promote human rights, who has been following the developments in the former Yugoslavia for, I think, the entire period in which the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia has operated. As many of you, or most of you, know, the tribunal was established a quarter of a century ago. When it was established, not many people took it very seriously. It was not able to obtain custody of the people who had been responsible for the crimes that were taking place in the former Yugoslavia during its earlier period. And there were times after it was created when many thought that it was going nowhere and that it should not be maintained. And there were also arguments that it would interfere with a peace settlement in the former Yugoslavia. So now 25 years have elapsed. There is quite a story to be told, but I think we don't really understand fully what the impact of the tribunal has been. And I think Diane Orentlicher's book is a major effort to help us to understand what we created and what impact it has had. I will introduce the people on the panel in a moment, but before I do so, I want to call on Anna Miriam Rocatello, who is the Deputy Director of the International Center for Transitional Justice, and the ICTJ is joining the Open Society Justice Initiative in sponsoring the event this evening.
To the Open Society Justice Initiative for giving us the opportunity to co-host this important event. And more importantly, I would like to thank and welcome Professor Orentlicher and our panelists tonight for sharing with us their reflection on the work of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and its impact in the countries directly affected by its work, namely Serbia and Bosnia. Professor Orentlicher's book, Some Kind of Justice, relates to the very core of the perennial struggle for criminal accountability. At the end of the day, what kind of justice and how much justice do these tremendous efforts yield? So reading the book, I was, of course, reminded of my many years in Kosovo trying to bring justice, to bring perpetrators of mass atrocities to justice. And I was reminded of the outright hostility that the Kosovo young professionals that I was meant to train and prepare for take over this big responsibility of the national prosecution of crime against humanity and war crimes were demonstrated against the ICTY. As the author underlines, the ICTY inspired governments to create war crimes tribunals in other countries. It also catalyzed national efforts to prosecute atrocities committed beyond the state borders, and its contribution to the development of the international criminal law is universally recognized. But the impact on the countries that experience the crimes under its purview until Professor Sortenlinker's remained unassessed. And at the book, as the book presents very well, that impact changed over time depending on circumstances, political dynamics, and it was certainly a study that presented challenges. So my organization, ICTJ's mission is to challenge the causes and address the consequences of massive human rights violation in order to affirm victims' rights and dignity, fight impunity, and promote responsive institutions. And we do that because we believe that breaking the cycle of massive human rights violations can lay the foundations for peace, justice, and inclusion. We are constantly confronted with the very topic of the book, what society and victims expect from these efforts. And I vividly remember a particular interview with a key witness in a war crime case against a group of Kosovo Albanian militants associated with the Kosovo Liberation Army that had perpetrated crimes against a fellow Kosovo Albanian labeled as collaborator of the Serbian regime. And this lady, this key witness, traveled for miles on a bus with her very young children to provide her testimony. In my official capacity, I had no resources to pay for her ticket, to offer her refreshment, or care for her children while we were taking her testimony. And at the end of the statement, I couldn't help but ask her, why do you do this? And in my mind was, do you realize the risk you are putting yourself and your young family under? And the answer was very simple. It was because it's the just thing to do. I was the one who witnessed it all. And even if I'm a Kosovo Albanian, there is no way I can justify what I saw. So this is why for us in this line of work, understanding what different society, different communities within the society, different individuals mean for justice is critical to help them determine what type of process, what type of institutions or mechanism is better fitted to address the needs and the atrocities that were committed within their context. These efforts and the resulting institution inevitably have different levels of success. But we are in ICTJ convinced that each step toward justice has an impact that needs to be evaluated in the longer term, because there are often unintended effects from certain effort that can result with the time and societal changes in opening opportunities in the future. And that's therefore crucial, in my opinion, that we take really inspiration from studies like Some Kind of Justice, and we continue to learn what works and how, and depending on the circumstances and depending on the historical moment we are living in. And with all of that, I just thank you all, and I'm joining the audience for this fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Let me now introduce the members of the panel. I will start at the far end. David Tolbert is currently a Ford Foundation fellow at Duke University, but until very recently, he served as the president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. I believe he was at the ICTJ from 2010 until 2018. And David has a long history of dealing with these issues, including a number of significant positions at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. One of his positions was as the deputy chief prosecutor for the ICTY. He has also represented the United Nations in dealing with the tribunals for Lebanon and also the extraordinary chambers for Cambodia. So he brings very rich experience. I could go on to a few other things, but his experience is very great in dealing with these issues. Taya Sefer is new to me. I haven't met her previously. I'm delighted to meet her. She is a 2013 graduate of American University and a leading activist in the Bosnian diaspora in the United States, a co-founder of the Bosnia and Herzegovina Diasporic Conference. She herself was an immigrant to the United States and became at an early age an activist on, I think, quite a range of issues, including LGBTQ issues. And I think it's very important to hear from somebody who is closely engaged in the activities of the Bosnian diaspora about the impact of the tribunal. And then the author of the book, Diane Arendtlecker, is somebody I've had the pleasure of working with for a great many years, going back a number of years before the establishment of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. I knew Diane first when she was deputy director of what was then called the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. Today it is Human Rights First. Diane is a professor of international law at the Washington College of Law of American University. She has served in the State Department as Deputy Ambassador for War Crimes. She has served as a United Nations independent expert on combating impunity, and she has written extensively on the question of accountability for mass atrocities. And the format we're going to pursue is I'm going to start by posing a few questions to Diane, and then I will pose a couple of questions to the other members of the panel, and Diane can respond to them and engage in colloquy, and then I will open it up to questions from the audience. I see quite a few people here who I recognize who are themselves very knowledgeable about these issues, so I expect that we will have an excellent discussion. And Diane, I'd like to begin with this question. I was one of those who was heavily involved in the attempt to establish the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And in that period, we talked about the rationale for establishing a tribunal. And one rationale that was expressed was we need to do this because we need to do justice. The people who have committed terrible crimes ought to be subject to retribution. Another argument for establishing the tribunal was that it was a way of demonstrating our respect for the victims of great abuses, and that putting on trial the people who had been responsible for their victimization was part of what we owed to the victims. Another argument was that when this conflict is over, we need to restore a sense of justice. And if there is such a tribunal, it will contribute to that. And another argument, not necessarily consistent with some of the other arguments, was that it would promote reconciliation. Yet another argument was that it was part of the truth process. That is, inevitably there would be efforts to revise history, and if there were court proceedings which had established the facts of what took place, that would help to prevent the rewriting of history. And then the other argument that I remember is that the nature of such a tribunal is that it would individualize guilt. We didn't want to say that a whole people, the Serbs, the Croats, whoever had committed these crimes, individuals were responsible for those crimes. And if those individuals were indicted and prosecuted and their guilt was established, that would counteract the collectivization of guilt and would help to individualize guilt. Diane, having looked at the impact of this tribunal, has it had, I mean, deterrence was also a factor that we talked about. Has it had any of these effects? Has it had some of them? To what degree has it had this kind of impact? And to complicate matters more, what value would you attach to these various arguments that were made for the establishment of such a tribunal?
Thank you. So first of all, I want to thank everybody for coming here on a rainy evening to talk about a pretty serious subject. And I'm especially grateful to ICTJ, which has been a partner in so much of this work, as Ari indicated. David, I can't even remember when I first met David because he's been working on these issues.
You didn't have such blonde hair on
Yes, you did. And as Arye indicated very modestly, he was really a seminal voice calling for the establishment of the ICTY. And the organization he led at that time sent me on my first mission to what was then Yugoslavia in 1991. So it's especially meaningful for me to be able to reflect on what we've learned in the last 25 years. And it's literally almost exactly 25 years because the ICTY was created 25 years ago, I think Monday of this week, a few days ago. And as earlier remarks indicated, it really unexpectedly set off a whole era of international justice, something we did not anticipate among the many things we looked to the ICTY to do 25 years ago. That one we did not expect. But it just set in motion a whole contemporary period of international justice. It's fascinating for me to hear you recall all of the goals that were ascribed to the ICTY. I haven't focused lately on what we all expected of it because I've been so immersed in trying to understand what Bosnians and Serbians expected of it. But where your recap aligns with what I heard in Bosnia is that an enormous amount of expectations were projected onto this court. And it's a somewhat paradoxical thing because, as you indicated, there was also a lot of cynicism and skepticism when it was created. That the word that was most often used to describe the ICTY when it was created was fig leaf. It was a fig leaf for the Security Council's failure to intervene to halt the slaughter underway. So they weren't going to do anything robust. They'll create a court to cover their consciences. So there was the cynicism on the one hand, but enormous expectations on the other. I was fiddling while Arye mentioned some of these goals because I was trying to find some of the early expectations of Bosnians. And I'm going to read you just one person's words. but I heard things like this all the time. So this is a journalist in Bosnia, Nijara Ahmet Tasevic. I hope I said that properly, remotely close. She said, many people here, maybe even I, expected that the tribunal will erase all the suffering and the pain and everything bad. And another person, Adin Hojic, made a similar point. We thought here in Bosnia that the judicial paradigm would do everything, would do the job of dealing with the past, that some good things will emerge from the trials on their own, and trials will have a positive impact on all other activities. Another woman in Serbia said something along the lines of, we attributed all these amazing powers to the ICTY. We thought it would bring justice. We thought it would bring reconciliation. We thought it would be reconciliation. So there were, you know, despite the sort of skepticism around this creature that was launched, there was also astonishing expectations. And so the whole question that set me off on this journey, and Arye was the one who enabled this to happen when I did my original study, was, well, so how's this working out for victims? By the time I did the first smaller version of this study, the ICTY had amassed a lot of successes that were visible internationally. It had it had acquired custody over a lot of fugitives who were not easy to find. It was handing down path-breaking jurisprudence, and we were all celebrating that. But then the question was, yeah, but so how's that working out for victims? Are they as excited as we are here in New York or in the global community? And what I found, so I'm finally going to answer your question, Arye, is
you're answering
that. So I'm going to try to make this short for now. So Bosnian survivors have many, 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 many disappointments in the ICTY. And I try to honor that in this book. I think the longest chapter is the chapter that describes their grievances. The trials take too long, sentences are too short, judges don't control the courtroom, not enough people were prosecuted, and it really goes on at some length. And they're not trivial complaints, and they're passionate. People feel very angry at the ICTY. And I didn't want to sugarcoat that, and I hope I didn't. But you would be missing the point of the book if you took away from that, that Bosnians are overall frustrated that the ICTY, with the experiment of the ICTY. And what I found over the course of interviews, over many visits, over an 8-year period, was that after I would hear a long series of justified complaints about the ICTY, I would ask people, okay, at the end of the interview, I've heard you, you're frustrated with this, you're angry at that. Now that you know how it's actually worked out, in light of everything you now know and what you've just described, was it a mistake to have created this tribunal? And then they would say, oh, no, 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 no. If we didn't have the ICTY, we wouldn't have had justice. And that's the most important thing. And if I can quickly find one quote, I'm not going to fumble for it. But there's one person who so beautifully captured that. I'm not going to be able to quickly find this. He criticized the tribunal, and the words aren't coming to me there. But then he said, after giving what seems like a devastating verdict, he said, but overall, it was excellent that it was created. And it was that paradox that I heard over and over and over again. So my takeaway from that is that of all the goals that we hoped the tribunal would achieve, unambiguously, it provided justice. And I periodically have to reread my book, as I did yesterday in preparation to this. And I am always so moved when I read the words of people I interviewed who talk about what justice meant to them. And in, as an academic, we're used to trying to capture things in hard metrics. It's very hard to capture what the survivors so eloquently expressed about what justice meant to them and what testifying meant to them and what it meant to bear witness for those who didn't survive. And it was and their words are so eloquent and powerful and moving. And I want so much for people in the policy world that I have been part of to understand how important that is. And it's deeply precious, it's inestimable, and it's very hard to capture. Second takeaway is that we have to do better. The complaints I mentioned are legitimate and they're correctable. And so for me, the good news is that judges and other judicial officers at the International Criminal Court and other tribunals can learn lessons. They can do better. Most of the complaints that Bosnians have been echoed by international experts. And there are things that can, there are ways to correct those and to deliver justice better. A second major achievement of the ICTY, and this is one that I didn't expect, was that it catalyzed domestic prosecutions. And I'm sure David will talk about this later. He played a very central role when he was at the ICTY in developing the partnership that emerged between the ICTY and the Bosnian court system and Serbian court system and other local courts. That to me is an amazing story. It was unanticipated. At a certain point, for reasons David might get into, the ICTY consciously decided to cultivate a domestic partner in Bosnia. It did not set about to have that effect in Serbia. It did not consciously work with the Serbian judiciary to strengthen it. Nonetheless, it had a catalytic effect in stimulating the creation of war crimes institutions in Serbia that nobody expected to be created. They're not operating perfectly. In fact, they're in serious trouble right now. But they've provided some measure of accountability that would not have happened without the ICTY. Here again, I think there's some super important lessons to learn from the ICTY's experience. One of the most important points that emerged from my research was that the current prosecutor, Serge Brammertz, seized the opportunity that emerged, went far beyond the four corners of his mandate, and developed a very creative relationship with domestic prosecutors and courts, and has really been there helping, partnering, assisting, bolstering, prodding when necessary, and that's often necessary. So I think we have some great models that are worth emulating. The harder story, and I don't know that I should get into it now because I want to leave room for other people to talk, and this is a bigger story. The harder story to tell is what the impact was on acknowledgement. So as you indicated, one of the really most important hopes that many people in both countries, but particularly notably in Serbia, one of their most cherished hopes was that the ICTY would dispel denial, which is a pervasive phenomenon in both countries. And if there was a sort of conscious theory behind their hopes, it was the ICTY, an international institution, a credible, impartial court, will establish the facts in a way no one can challenge, and nobody will be able to deny that these atrocities happened or that they happened to the degree that they did. It didn't work out the way they expected, and again, that's a more complicated story. I guess short answer is the ICTY had some impact in that sphere, and it was palpable for a while, during a period when conditions were relatively auspicious in both Bosnia and Serbia. For the past 10 years, there's been a retrenchment. And so it did not have the magical effect that many people hoped it would have. So I'll say leave it at there for now.
Can I pursue that question? One of the virtues of the ICTY, from my standpoint, has been that it did prosecute war criminals from all parties to the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia. And that has not been the case with respect to other international tribunals. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, for example, has been criticized because it did not prosecute anybody associated with the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And I wonder whether you feel that had a significant part in enhancing the credibility of the ICTY, or whether the complaint that it didn't prosecute enough people from certain parties in effect overrode what I think of as very even-handed performance by the ICTY.
Right. So I think it was absolutely essential that it examined war crimes committed by all sides to the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia. It would have had no credibility if it hadn't done that. Unfortunately, that wasn't enough to dispel denial. And I want to be careful here because I think it did have an impact, and I think that it did make it harder credibly to deny that atrocities occurred on a vast scale. It did not settle arguments once and for all about the degree to which different parties were responsible, right? It did not do that. So, for example, to be more specific, many Serbs in Bosnia believe that, or assert that all sides committed war crimes equally. So it's a very dominant narrative. All sides committed atrocities, and the implication is equally. And on surveys, when they're asked questions on public opinion surveys, who committed the most crimes, the answer that is most frequently checked by Serbs in Bosnia is all sides equally. And so unless the ICTY charged all sides equally and convicted all sides equally, many of the Serbs in Bosnia will consider it biased. And they're not comforted by the fact that the ICTY also prosecuted perpetrators of crimes against Serbs, particularly since some of the most high-profile defendants who were prosecuted for crimes against Serbs were acquitted. So it's I wish it were that easy, Arye. It's mm-hmm. a lot messier.
Okay. I see in the audience Priscilla Hayner, and we had a discussion here recently about Priscilla's new book, which deals with the conflicts that can arise between the effort to establish peace and the effort to do justice. And I wonder if you feel there are any lessons that can be learned from what happened in the former Yugoslavia with respect to that issue. It was debated, for example, in advance of the Dayton peace talks, when the prosecution of the ICTY had previously indicted Radovan Karadzic and General Mladic, but it indicted them again just before the Dayton peace talks, and indicted them at that point for the massacre at Srebrenica, and it was therefore impossible for them to attend the Dayton peace talks. And the argument was that the effort to do justice is making it impossible to negotiate a peace settlement. It didn't work out that way, but is that something that was peculiar to the situation in Yugoslavia, or is there any general lesson that we can learn from the way that issue played out in the former Yugoslavia?
Yeah. So I actually recently bought Priscilla's book, and I am dying to read it. I haven't yet, so I can't wait to see what you say about this. But my own sense is, everything is so fact specific that it's hard to, I'm looking to Priscilla, Priscilla is nodding, that it's hard to generalize from it. What I think is useful about the Bosnia case study is that it is an example of a context where at several points during the pre-peace and post-peace moment, there was a peace versus justice dilemma. And it was, you know, teed up in those terms and a raging debate about whether the ICTY was going to imperil the prospects for peace. And at each moment in the resolution of that debate, I think the justice side prevailed, in by which I mean it turned out that indicting, to pick up on your example, indicting Karadzic and Mladic right before the Dayton peace negotiations did not derail the negotiations as diplomats had warned it would. And in fact, because Karadzic was indicted, he could not participate in the negotiations in Dayton. And the Bosnian president who did participate said he wouldn't have come if Karadzic were there. So most people who've looked at that moment conclude that it turned out that the high-profile second indictment by Goldstone was helpful, facilitated a peace negotiation.
That was not Goldstone's purpose in the indictment.
He wanted to avoid an amnesty, right? I mean, was there something else that you wanted to? Yeah, right. So I think, and another moment that I would mention that I think is important is after the peace agreement was concluded, it had it authorized the NATO force that was deployed in Bosnia to arrest people indicted by the ICTY, but did not require them to do so. So there was a period of 18 months or so when the NATO force would not would not arrest indicted fugitives. It would wave high-profile suspects like Karadzic through checkpoints, just wouldn't arrest them. And then finally, things changed, and they started arresting people. The British government changed. Tony Blair, Robin Cook brought in an ethical foreign policy. They were the leading edge in that change. Clinton was elected for a second term. Madeleine Albright became Secretary of State. Leadership changes in several countries played a really important role in that. And then people were arrested. And suddenly the force discovered they could arrest war criminals without derailing the peace. So the reason that connects to the peace versus justice debate is that the NATO forces and the governments they reported to were afraid that it would destabilize the fragile peace that had finally been put in place to arrest these high-profile suspects. Everybody I interviewed for this book believes with great certainty, and again, there may be people who see things differently, that had the NATO forces arrested the war criminals earlier, the peace would have been much stronger. And that period, that crucial period of the first 18 months, was a period where the war criminals were able to regroup, reconsolidate, strengthen their criminal networks, and that Bosnia is still paying the price for that period. So I think Bosnia is a case study that shows us that there are times when it makes sense, when you can best advance your objectives of securing the peace by not shortchanging justice. I don't think you can generalize from that, but what I think is useful about that, and I really came to appreciate this when I was in the State Department, you face crises every day in the State Department, every day. There's a new calamity of, if not every 10 minutes. And you don't have time to reflect, you don't have time to research, and you don't have time to bone up on similar situations. And you have to be able to draw quickly on analogous contexts that might have a lesson. And I think it's useful to be aware of these moments because there were times when I encountered new challenges in the State Department. It was really helpful for me to be aware of how similar situations played out in Bosnia. And I could be more effective making arguments in our internal policy debates about what we should do by being able to pull out an example that was very similar to the facts we were confronting, and people listened and they cared because it was an experience that had a lesson that seemed relevant now. Would it be relevant to every situation? No, but it was relevant to some, and that was incredibly valuable. It was very precious to know that.
Diane, I could keep asking you questions for a long time, but I want to turn to our other panelists. And let me start with you, Taya. I wonder if you would tell us how you, as a Bosnian in the diaspora, and you and your family and your friends and the other members of the Bosnian diaspora with whom you are in contact, how do you feel about the court? Do you think of it as a great achievement? Do you think it played an immensely significant role?
First of all, thank you for having me here. I'm very excited to just be on this panel and to be talking with you all. And also having the chance to read Diane's book was very just powerful for me. I wanted to, in my head, I was making a joke earlier, Diane, when you were talking about how Bosnians felt about the court and the fact that we have a lot of criticisms, but at the end of the day, we're like, no, it's good, because that's like our cultural thing, right? Like, we're very hypercritical. We're like, no, we like this thing. It's just terrible in all these ways. So, like, and so when then it comes to a personal, you know, situation, it gets amplified. And so coming from my perspective, and some of you might be seeing I'm wearing this white armband. Today is the white armband day to recognize what happened in Prijedor. Many Bosnian Muslims were required to wear white armbands or put white sheets outside of their homes in Prijedor and across Bosnia to signify that they were Muslim so that they could be basically open targets. And we're talking about you know, how much time has passed. My birthday was last week, and I turned 26, and it's been 26 years since my dad was in a concentration camp and tortured, and he had to wear this armband walking out of that camp. So when, you know, my family talks about this, and when my community talks about this, I remember watching the trials and watching the verdicts come out and watching the sentencing, and my experience and a lot of the experience of my community was like, oh, thank God somebody's finally talking about it. Like, there's this level of validation that I think a lot of people were looking for. And part of that validation, and I do want to get I'll probably get more into this later, is the former Yugoslavia was stuck in this, like, right, it was in the East, but also in the West. We kind of played friends with everybody. And so looking for validation from the ICTY was like, oh, look, mom and dad are on our side. Like, the West actually believes us for once. Mm-hmm. Like, they, or not for once, but like, the West believes what we're saying. They, like, there is truth. And there is justice in that. I held that feeling while at the same time being extremely heartbroken that it was not declared that there was genocide in my hometown, even though, you know, I would say that it happened there. And that's the issue that we run into with legal definitions of what is genocide and what courts can actually serve, right? If we're using, and Diane talks about this a lot in her book, if we're using the Holocaust and how Germany faced justice and kind of punishment and the perpetrators faced punishment in that realm, if we're using that as the bar that you have to achieve, it is very hard for any other folks involved in any other conflict to achieve that bar in order to feel like their struggle was valid. So I see that a lot in my community of Srebrenica is recognized. People talk a lot about Foča because of the extreme sexual violence that happened there. But this happened all across the country. And just because there wasn't an ability to find a legal definition and to meet the legal qualifications of what is genocide doesn't mean that trauma doesn't exist. So I feel like that's part of the tension, right? Like, there's still an appreciation for the court and that it existed, but also a disappointment that it can't go further. As for, I'm also Serbian, so as for my Serbian side of the family, this is the fun line I get to dance across. You know, it's, I don't think the court decisions impacted them as much as their fury at the Serbian government during the 90s. And the, and you know, the every time I read a book about like how Serbians feel about Milosevic, and I'm not going to deny that there aren't a lot of people who do really respect and see him as this, you know, this god to them, there's also many that blame him, rightfully so, for the extreme economic desolation of Serbia and the fact that the unemployment rates are skyrocketing and there is very few opportunities there. So that's just from my own personal network and what that kind of looks like. I think the other aspect to it, so my hometown's in Republika Srpska, so if you want to get more complicated, just like keep asking me details. I'll come up with more ways that my life is interesting. But within Republika Srpska, it intensifies a little bit, right? Because we have this narrative of the West coming after Serbs, right? And the West is anti-Serb, and that's why Serbians have to align with the East. And, you know, we're not going to ignore that. And I'm going to conflate a little bit Serbs in the RS and Serbs in Serbia, but President Vučić was at Putin's coronation recently, right? So this is, you can't ignore that these things are happening together. I don't think that any international court could have tried any war criminals without it being framed as, oh, the West is coming out, like as a continued narrative of the West coming to get the Serbs because everyone's against us. So all of these things kind of, there's these multiple truths and these multiple things happening at the same time.
David, I was told before this panel that you were particularly taken with Diane's chapter 7 on denial and acknowledgement in Serbia. So I wonder if you would say something about that subject.
Yeah, I think I told you.
Okay. Somebody told me.
I didn't mean to set it up. I didn't really mean to set it up that way, but... before I turn to your question, I did want to say a couple of things that have been talked about. Dayton, I think, is something that's worth examining and discussing in some detail. It may have stopped a conflict, but in a way, the divisions that it created between the Republika Srpska and Bosnia and Herzegovina, the Federation, is something that we can never get over in a way. So when we think about peace and justice, sure, I mean, I think that the justice discussion is really important, but here is a peace agreement that at its heart leads to more conflict or leads to great disaffection between the groups. So one of the key issues here when we're thinking of peace and justice in the discussion, let's never have another Dayton again. I mean, Dayton has created an ongoing conflict that I think everybody recognizes for now, ever since the agreement has been signed in 1995. And what is the way out of that? We're stuck with Dayton and how to get out of that moment. So I think when we think about the peace and justice equation, we have to be a little bit more visionary and try to think a little bit more onto the... I know there's a great deal of pressure, there's an enormous amount of pressure to stop the killing. But there has to either be a mechanism or approach which addresses that on a longer term, because you have a frozen conflict and now you have each party going to their own corners, they're going to their own schools, and you've done what Milosevic and the radical nationalists want. And that is what Dayton has resulted in. So I think all the the justice issues are important, and I'll go into that, but I do think it's worth keeping that in mind. If I can come back to Diane's book, I thought it was a tremendous book, and I'm not being paid to tout it, but I really, as was mentioned, I spent 9 years at the Yugoslavia Tribunal and another 3 years with another organization working in the region, and I went back and did a big study on the Bosnia State Court, which I worked on extensively, and I have one or two or three little differences with Diane that maybe we'll get into later, but I do think it is an enormously informative book. It is deep, both not just from a legal point of view, but from a sociological point of view. And this is why one of the reasons I had so much interest in the denial chapter. But I read the whole book. I didn't read all the footnotes, as I told Diane earlier, but I do think it is it's a masterful piece of work, and even if I do have one or two points of minor disagreement, I think it's a very comprehensive look at a lot of different issues, including one that I worked on extensively, which was the relationship with the Bosnia State Court and building that up, and then it's very interesting to see how that has worked out. I thought the chapter on denial was particularly significant because I think if you work in the fields of transitional justice and accountability, the question of acknowledgement and the flip side of that, denial, are the key issues that we deal with, because ultimately victims are looking to be acknowledged. They want the state authorities, they want others to acknowledge what's happened. Now, court judgments help that, but apologies help that. Truth commissions help that. And one thing that gave me a second thought when I was reading through the book is that the ICTY, I worked for McDonald and I was very close to Obor, and they really put the brakes on the proposed truth commission in Bosnia, which in retrospect is something that I don't think we should have done. I mean, we should have let that play out, because the more measures and mechanisms that might have been involved, I think the more acknowledgement or at least denial might have been eroded. But what I found so useful and about this chapter on Serbian denial, there's also a chapter on Bosnia living in enforced denial that I thought was very good too. But the sociologists and social scientists are brought into that part of the book and their discussion, and explained in a very straightforward but analytical way about the forms of denial, motivated forgetting. We all do a little bit about that, we see this in the Republic Srpska and Serbia in particular. Belief, perseverance, and I think it was a really important chapter because it explained not simply in legal terms or in terms of those of us who work on accountability and transitional justice, but it explained it in social science terms. And as I think back, at the ICTY, we had a lot of experts on a lot of things, including a Victims and Witnesses Unit. But I don't think we ever thought through what the ICTY might do around denial and how those judgments might be used. When I worked with Gabriel McDonald when she was president, we created this outreach program, which I think was really the first time this had happened, where we tried to explain what happened in the Yugoslavia Tribunal due to all this great misunderstanding and actually misuse of the judgments and propaganda, because we were this court sitting in The Hague and the victims are out in Bosnia and elsewhere. We focused on Bosnia and tried to explain that. And it would have been really useful, I think, to have a better understanding of these the sociological concepts. Maybe we had one or two experts at that, but we really, I don't think we understood, or we didn't talk about the importance of acknowledgement. We didn't talk about the importance of either the judgments of the tribunal or other sources to combat denial, because ultimately, I think the ICTY's work to a large extent in Serbia has been undermined by this persistent denial, and I think we should try to learn from that, and other transitional justice mechanisms and courts, how we can better get across these decisions and these processes in a way that gets at denial and moves forward on acknowledgement. And frankly, if I think about my years there, I don't think we ever talked in terms of acknowledgement and denial. I think we're court, obviously, but the court became a battleground in many ways, or the court's decision became a battleground in many ways. And this question of the role of acknowledgement and denial, I think, is such a critical one. I also would, just as a sidebar, because I think Diane's book does a good job of describing it, I think there were a lot of, we shot ourselves in the foot, or we had our own goals, particularly with the Gotovina, Perisic, Haradinaj, Sechel, there's a long list of cases in which the judgments were baffling for insiders and for outsiders. You can't control ultimately what judges do, but I think it goes to a point that I felt very strongly about when I was there and continue to feel about it to this day. You need judges who actually have done some judging, I think, for the most part. And sometimes some of the judges I felt like got lost in theorizing. One has to have an understanding of what the victims are feeling and suffering. You can't base guilt or innocence just on that. But some of the doctrines I felt like led the court astray and completely confused and baffled the outside world. And I think that is a lesson that we should learn, and something I have a great regrets about, and I think probably anybody associated with the tribunal. So those are a few comments.
Yeah. Diane, I wonder, you indicated that some of the acquittals of Croat defendants had undermined the credibility of the tribunal in Serbia, and I wonder if you'd sort of reflect on some of the relatively recent decisions by the appeals chamber of the tribunal, and whether you think those have significantly diminished the long-term impact of the tribunal.
Did you want to say something else, or you looked like you wanted to?
Yeah. I did. I wanted to say really briefly, thank you. I wanted to say really briefly that I think this question of denial, especially by folks in Serbia, is complex, and I won't try and belabor this for too long. Given how the court was structured and the order in which prosecution happened and what criminals were gone after in what order, I think there was a panic and a worry about, would the court go after smaller perpetrators of crimes? Would it go after everybody, or would it just go after the leaders? So I think that has spurred a lot of continued denial in the Serbian community, because these were mothers and parents and sisters watching their brothers and sons go off unwillingly in many cases to war. And so if you start admitting and saying, yes, this happened, you're not just saying, yes, it happened over there. You're saying, yes, and maybe my son is going to go to jail for it. And I think there's a complexity there of protection. And even as I was reading kind of like the survey respondents and who thought what actually happened or who should serve, who should face justice for it. And it comes up in that way of people were trying to protect each other. I mean, you look again at what happened in Yugoslavia after World War II and how justice was served to Ustasha and Chetniks. There was serious punishments that came out of that. So, and that was not that long ago. So people knew that that happened to their parents, to grandparents, to people that were forced out of the country or were put in prison, and they didn't want to see that happen to their kids. So I feel like it's easier to do that psychological spin and be like, no, that there's no way that happened, because of that fear of what that justice would look like in the 90s and the 2000s and even to this day.
Thank you. Can I also just react to that? Yes. And then answer your question? So I'm glad you said that. I found the whole issue of denial and the phenomena of denial fascinating. And I hate to say fascinating because that sounds dangerously close to fun, and it's serious and discouraging. But a lot of the social science research that I talked about, and which Serbians I interviewed, you know, they reached the same conclusions as social science research without knowing it. They described to me in brilliantly astute, perceptive terms the psychological dynamics at play along lines of what Taya described. And then I read all the social science research, which gave, you know, put fancy labels on the phenomena that these very insightful Serbs described to me. And so there are these very human dynamics at play, which helped me understand denialism in terms that were sometimes less sinister than I suppose I imagined it before I understood this better. David and I were both at a conference a couple of weeks ago in Nuremberg, about the Tokyo Tribunal. And one of the most memorable moments for me of this conference was a Japanese government official was talking about some anodyne thing, Japanese government's diplomatic position negotiating the International Criminal Court, da, da, da. And then she just added out of nowhere at the end of this two-day conference, and it's really hard looking back because she had been hearing allusions to people kind of dancing around, not really squarely addressing, but dancing around the fact that Japanese society overall has not embraced the findings of the Tokyo Tribunal, which handed down its judgment 70 years ago. 70 years later, it's still not accepted widely. And she was reacting to this theme that was always percolating around the surface of the conference, and she just blurted out, you know, it's really hard to accept that our grandparents and our parents did something this awful. And so some of the dynamics behind denialism that Taya, you know, very beautifully described, it's your family, you're talking about your family, it's very hard to imagine that your son or your husband killed somebody or killed a child. It's really hard to imagine that. And then there's so many other more complex things layered onto that. So the psychological barriers are very real, and it is important to understand it. I found myself challenged at times by some of the things I heard. For me, one of the most challenging things, in the sense of challenging some of the things I've always believed, is a really impressive Bosnian Serb who has worked tirelessly to educate fellow Serbs about the extent of Serb atrocities. He was describing a program that the ICTY developed called Bridging the Gap, which was very consciously designed to engage the issues David was talking about. So the whole concept was, oh my gosh, there's all this misunderstanding, there's all this misinformation about the ICTY. We're demonized, they don't understand what we're doing at all. They say we're doing this, we're not, you know, it was like, and so we've got to do something about this. So somebody who David has worked with in a number of contexts, a brilliant, wonderful journalist and activist named Refik Hojic, designed a program called Bridging the Gap, which brought ICTY officials, including David, to Summit, right?
The first one in Birch Cove.
Mm-hmm. And so they would go to the towns where atrocities that had been prosecuted at the ICTY had actually occurred, and officials like David and investigators would explain, so here's how we went about investigating, here's why we ended up with these defendants, here's why the judgment reached these conclusions. And they would do that when the appeal judgment was over, so there was no more casework ahead. And in some of the Bridging the Gap town halls, there was like a transformative dropping of the scales. There were and it brought chills, down my spine to hear about these moments. And this wonderful guy, Branko Todorovic, would describe a town where denial was just thick as a wall, and it seemed impossible to pierce denial. And they would show a film of somebody from Focha who'd been convicted, talking, testifying on the stand, and the prosecutor would ask, correct me if I've got this wrong, David, and so you raped a 12-year-old child, yes, I raped, and he said something like, and I would have done worse things, but I have a daughter at home too, and so Branko Todorovic is describing this, and he said, you could hear a pin drop, and he said, and I thought, it was so heavy, and this is a town where denial is, it's hard to exaggerate, I've been there, it's really thick. And he said, I thought nobody would come back after lunch, but everybody did, and they listened. And so the thing he said that really stuck in my mind, and I mentioned this in the book, and it really has challenged me, is he said, sometimes when you demand that people, and he was talking about Serbs there, say, yes, it happened, and we're guilty too because we were bystanders and we didn't stand up. Yes, yes. What do you want me to say? Yes, we're all terrible. He said, when you push them in a wall, they have nowhere to go. But, if you sort of step back and let them discover this and don't keep on pounding the table and say, stop denying, they can come to this. And I was fascinated by that, and I think about it a lot. I'm not quite sure what the lessons are, but I do think that this whole issue that I deal with principally in Chapter 7, but also when I go on to Bosnia, presents challenges that those of us in the field have to sort of do a better job of grappling with. To your question, Arye. So the ICTY had a series of terrible judgments, and it was heartbreaking because it came late in its life, and it took a long time for the ICTY to apprehend the people who were kind of the faces of evil for many survivors, the people who were the masterminds of mass atrocity. They eluded justice for a very long time. He wasn't able to stay for the whole program, but David Pressman was here a little earlier. He was in the White House when I was at the State Department. And one of the things we spent a lot of time on was trying to get Ratko Mladic arrested. He was arrested while we were still there. And it was... It took so long for him to be arrested. It happened like 15 years after he was first indicted for genocide. And for survivors, they waited so long for this. They waited so long for the top guys to finally get to court. And they were getting older, and sadly, many of the people who cherished this hope for so long didn't live to see Mladic arrested, much less convicted. And finally, the latter years arrive, and they're arrested. All these guys are finally apprehended after epic searches to apprehend them. Instead of this beautiful, sweet moment of long-delayed justice at last, the tribunal kind of lost its senses, went crazy, started issuing, as David said, incomprehensible judgments. And it was beyond frustrating for survivors because they had waited so long for justice, and then there were these very controversial acquittals. It's also very problematic, to say the least, for human rights advocates who had really taken great risks in their own country to defend the ICTY, to confront denialism in their societies, to say, listen, you've got to stop denying that a genocide happened in Srebrenica. The ICTY has held that it did. And now people were saying to them, yeah, your ICTY, the one you keep telling us we have to believe, aren't they the ones that came up with this loony theory and acquitted Shechel and acquitted Gotovina and acquitted Hrodnoy? And so these advocates, there was like the rug was pulled out from under them. And so it was a terrible period. And when you're in international court, you don't have forever to get it right. You have a finite period. Every decision counts. So it was a terrible period for the ICTY. Even its most staunch defenders lost faith in it. The good news is there was a course correction. And one of the really terrible acquittals was reversed. And now the two people who were acquitted are on trial again in front of a residual mechanism. Thankfully, Ratko Mladic was convicted and sentenced to life in prison, and he was convicted of genocide. And it was so powerful. It was just such a powerful moment. And it would have been powerful under any circumstances. But after all these awful decisions, it was especially important to survivors. Yes. And I remember one woman who had testified in his trial talked about what it meant for him to be convicted, and she talked about how it brought peace to her soul. And after everything she had lost, that was an astonishing thing to say. So horrible, but got better.
Okay. We don't have much time left, and I'd like to open this to a few questions from the audience. If you want to ask a question, would you come to the mic and would you identify yourself? And if you as you identify yourself, please know that we're recording this, and we will use the recording. So you are giving your consent to have your question broadcast. So with that, if you come to the mic, Richard Wilson.
One thing I'd like to mention briefly, Richard Wilson, University of Connecticut. School of Law. I'd like to mention just the quality of the decisions. Yes, there were some baffling decisions in Shechel and other cases, but the quality of law, of international criminal law, is really the highest of any tribunal thus far. So the ICTY is the high watermark of international criminal law. And the precedent that rape is a war crime comes through the ICTY. The genocide decisions in Popovich, in Mladic, and in Karadzic are much better done than the ICTR. So the body of jurisprudence that it's leaving for future prosecutions for mass atrocities is really generally quite good. And we can say compared to what? Compared to other tribunals. But I don't know if you've looked at domestic criminal justice recently, but there are many baffling decisions at the domestic level as well, just to point that out. One of my questions would be, looking forward to the ICC, was to what degree, so my question, and I guess this is really for Diane and for David, is some of that success related to the ICTY being an ad hoc tribunal? The ICC has not provided the same high level of productivity or jurisprudence. It's a permanent court. I wonder if you would just assess that in relation to each other. To what degree is this a model? I mean, insofar as we can understand U.S. foreign policy, it seems like the State Department's preferred model is an ad hoc tribunal for say, Syria or some future conflicts. Is that a better model, or should we be putting more emphasis on the International Criminal Court?
Who wants to take that? Sure. David?
Yeah, sure. I think that's a couple of great questions.
Can you hear me? Hear me now? Okay. I think a couple of great questions, very much appreciated. I do think the quality of the law was very high at the ICTY. In terms of, I think what, if I can just say two sentences about the judgments that went off the rail, which I'll do, and then I'll think I'll come to the more important question about ad hoc tribunals and so forth. Yes, how about this? Can you all hear me now?
Thank you.
My wife usually sits in the back of the room and louder. So what I was saying is that I do agree that I think the overall the quality of the ICTY's judgment and jurisprudence, and I would also say the quality of the advocacy on the prosecution side and sometimes the defense, I think that was more spotty, was very high. I think one of the problems is that with joint criminal enterprise and some other doctrines that were applied, we perhaps had a few too many. Now, the question was asked by an academic, so it would be unfair to point the finger at academics. But maybe overly sophisticated and got pointed in the wrong direction. What I think is more harmful there, actually, is there were allegations that these decisions would help the Americans or the Israelis and so forth. So that is that the decisions would be beneficial to a great, to a military power. This was certainly written up in articles and so forth. So this was part of it was one of the elements that people don't want to talk about, but it certainly undermined the credibility. So the decisions couldn't be understood, and therefore there were a lot of conspiracy theories. Secondly, on the question of whether ad hoc tribunals, or I think I would also include hybrid tribunals and other mechanisms. There's also the organ trafficking tribunal in The Hague on Kosovo as well. I think actually, after looking at the ICC for a number of years, I think everybody is really disappointed. There are a limited number of cases. The quality of the lawyering and judicial side have been lacking to some extent. I think the ICC has gotten stronger, but it's pretty clear that the ICC is only going to deal with a relatively small number of cases. So I think that we should think about all the tools in the toolbox, including the model from the Special Court for Sierra Leone. I wouldn't say the ECCC because I worked on that for a year, and that's not the model you want to follow, but the court in Cambodia. But I think there's some other examples that if you're serious about criminal accountability for serious crimes, you should be looking to do this. And we are seeing in the Central African Republic, there's an attempt on a hybrid model. Very, very tough situation. And a couple of other instances as well. I don't think the ICC by itself is going to provide, at least in the near term, a great deal of accountability. And so I think you're right, Richard, that we ought to be looking much more broadly. Thanks.
If I can add to that, I would share the disappointment with the ICC, but I don't think the State Department's reasons for preferring ad hoc tribunals should be given that much credit. Ultimately, the State Department is concerned that the ICC would have jurisdiction over Americans if Americans commit crimes in countries that are parties to the ICC. And so I think that hostility to the ICC may explain to a certain extent the preference for ad hoc tribunals. I don't say necessarily the State Department when you were there, but I think that would be true of the State Department today and perhaps the State Department at the time that the ICC was created.
Very briefly, because I don't want to keep you waiting, but one thing that strikes me a lot about the ICTY is that it had a kind of commitment and consensus behind, political consensus behind it, that we haven't seen quite for any other court. And it's remarkable that it apprehended everybody who was at large. It doesn't happen easily. But part of what happened was there was a very strong consensus behind it that the ICC has never had, just a really strong consensus. And advocates locked in some of the power behind that consensus in a way that carried the ICTY through periods when the consensus might have frayed. For example, the policies of conditionality that the that first Washington and then the European Union deployed to put pressure on Serbia to arrest fugitives. If you went back 5 years after the ICTY was operating and tried to pass some of the legislation or build in conditionality, it would have been really hard to build a consensus to really wield those levers of pressure effectively. But the policies were locked in, the legislation was passed when the consensus was strongest. And it was that proved to be enormously important later when the consensus broke down. And the ICC never got the consensus in the first place and has never had anything remotely comparable. So beyond all the other things that my book focuses on, I think the ICTY is a great study in advocacy around tribunals and what it takes to make them succeed.
Diane, can I just ask Diane a question? And I'll make it very short.
Maybe I should.
You know, there is this window in the 90s. Berlin Wall comes down, the Soviet Union becomes Russia, et cetera. You know, this happens for a period of 10 years. ICTY evolves. ICC is adopted. By the end of that period, that ends. Now we're in a pretty deep crisis. So to me, the political situation ultimately determines all of this. And what we have to reinvigorate or try to invigorate is the human rights movement for accountability and so forth. More broadly, ultimately, this has to be driven civil society and changing the political context, because ultimately it's the political context that allows for whatever form of accountability you're going to have. And to me, that is the real challenge that faces us, not just in the US, but across the world. And if we can't change that political context, whatever mechanism we're going to put forward is not going to work. So,
go ahead.
Thank you. Considering what happened in the former Yugoslavia, and you saw it firsthand, considering what's happening in South Africa with the whites fleeing to Australia, considering that I just read in the Wall Street Journal this week that George Soros, Open Society, said that it was a mistake to bring so many people from around the world with different persuasions to countries in Western Europe. We should have helped the people stay in Africa by giving them aid. Do you think that it's been a mistake to have so many different peoples of different groupings mixing together when maybe human nature won't allow for it, or maybe we're just not ready, evolution hasn't reached that point yet?
Question.
There you go.
Go ahead.
Thanks very much. Fascinating panel. Priscilla Hayner. And thanks very much, Arye, earlier for your mention of my book, which I'm going to make reference to in a minute. What I thought was actually the most interesting and important and actually shocking thing that you all have said was, in fact, 25 years in, this is the first sort of serious in-depth treatment as to what the impact is of the tribunal in the country or countries at hand, which I think is actually sort of an indictment on the rest of us, in a sense. And thank you very much, Diane, for doing this for all of us. The second thing I thought was really interesting and important is, David, that you said that actually from within the ICTY, when you were there, it actually wasn't sort of a priority question on you all's minds as to how to have that effect in country on countering denial and advancing acknowledgement. So one thing that I try to argue in the context of particularly the ICC, but really any tribunal in my book, is that in fact international tribunals or hybrid tribunals, essentially they're political animals whether they want to be or not. They're affected by politics and local realities and the context at hand, and they're going to affect it, whether they intend to or not. And in the case of the ICC, they of course influence national actors' decisions, including through a deterrent effect, if they operate wisely and take into account all the contextual factors. So of course it naturally raises the question as to whether in this case, especially David, but certainly Diane and Haya as well, are there things that you all see that the ICTY, looking back, could have understood differently about its mandate? So it didn't think that its impact was only through having correct, legally sound, clear, strong judgments, but actually through its statements, through its outreach, through thinking about how it can impact in various ways the decisions and the views and understanding of local populations. There aren't any, you know, they didn't have other transitional justice mechanisms agreed at Dayton, and you don't want a tribunal to try to fill all of those gaps, but it seems as if having a purely legal approach in a context where the local population is expecting these wider impacts sort of was a missed opportunity, perhaps, or the question is, was it? Thanks very much.
Yeah. I think the early understanding, particularly of judges and prosecutors and so forth, was this is a court, it speaks through its judgments, et cetera, like a traditional national court. I think that did change to some extent. So if I wasn't clear about that, I think the creation of an outreach program, which includes what we were talking about in Birchco, which Diane talked about it in FOCA and other places, I actually, you know, that probably was my proudest day in the ICTY was when I chaired the meeting in Birchco, which was the first what we call bridging the gap, because we spent the day and actually went through the cases, but we went through the victims and we went through what they said and we played testimony. And before that, we walked around with a large group of people and we saw where the executions occurred and so forth. I think that kind of event, that kind of discussion where we spent a whole day going through investigation, judgment, showing who the victims were, had an impact in a kind of deep kind of way. I think that there's some criticism there, and you know, when did we do that? Probably, you know, in 2006 or 2007. I mean, so it's well into the tribunal's mandate, and the outreach program was something that I worked with on Judge McDonald, and she left, and it was kind of an orphan child for a long time because courts don't do that. So this was an enormous fight. Refik fortunately joined me and others in this kind of struggle. I think that battle was won over the long term, but what I think also has happened, and I see this at the ICC, is that, and Refik coined this term, not me, but I use it. It's called check the outreach box. You know, because now outreach is I think is what they call it. We need to do some outreach, and therefore we're going to have some programming. And the outreach department of the ICTY put out a 45 slick page pamphlet, brochure about all the great work they did and paid for by the European Union. And I looked at it and I went ballistic because this is not what outreach is about. It's actually reaching victims. And I wrote them a really nasty note. So I probably can't go back to the ICTY anytime soon. But it seems to me that this is becomes the kind of the problem is that outreach needs to be something beyond out. How do you engage the victims of these crimes who are affected by those judgments? And that's what happened in Birchco, and that's what happened in FOCA, and not nearly enough happened. And I'm afraid from what I've seen at the ICC, and it would be unfair to make a full judgment, is that it's
It's much more of the kind of check the box and talk about victims rather than dealing with victims. And it's a step for a court, but it's a critically important step if you're going to address that issue of denial and if you're going to actually be a court that addresses the, you know, the needs of victims and not simply, of course, dispensing justice is important, but you've got a moral duty to go much further, in my view. So hopefully I clarified that. Yeah.
I just want to very quickly say I agree with everything David said, but one of the themes that sort of emerged for me in the course of the research was that how effective the ICTY was, however we define effective, and that's, you know, a long story, how effective it was on the ground in the countries that experience violence turned to an enormous extent on how effectively external actors were addressing politics on the ground in those countries. So you know, Priscilla, better than most people, how arduous the process of recovery is after a conflict. It's hard work, it's the work of generations, and the work never ends because the dangers are always there. You think you have a solid, vibrant democracy, and wham, you just get hit upside the head. And everything is upside down. You don't know how to get your bearings. And you have to reconstruct and do super hard work. And one of the things that, one of the many wise observations I heard from a Serbian activist was courts don't set political reality right. And that a big mistake many activists made was expecting the ICTY to do everything. And it sort of made them complacent sometimes about doing all the other hard work that had to happen politically in their societies. But the ICTY had a relatively good impact on acknowledgement and other things when the high representative was exercising his extraordinary powers in Bosnia in a robust way, when he was firing people from positions of political power who were war criminals and stirring up trouble. And in Serbia, the ICTY actually, in some ways, indirectly empowered reformists. And right, and when there's a transition, it's a struggle. There's a struggle between the old guard and the reformists who want to get a country back on track. And the power dynamics are complicated and messy, and all important to the trajectory of the recovery. Right. And so what often happened during the early 20s is that external actors, first the United States, then the European Union, intervened in a concerted and smart way. And it was about politics. It was somewhat about the ICTY, but it was about the internal politics. And for a period in time, the ICTY and the politics came together in a really constructive and interesting way. And so one of my own lessons learned from the ICTY experience is that these tribunals can do something that's absolutely necessary and vital and inestimably important and precious. And we should never underestimate how important the ICTY was to survivors. But there's so much more they can do if we do all the other things we have to do and pay attention to the hard work of recovery in a society that has seen the worst and gone through unthinkable atrocities. And when we pay attention to those other things, tribunals can have a rather constructive impact in ways that we can't even imagine. And just to give one little example, we talked earlier about, I'll wrap it up, the impact in catalyzing domestic prosecutions. One of the reasons that matters is that there's now a lot of research showing that the more domestic human rights trials you have, the better your human rights environment is. So there's a lot of knock-on effects that can happen, but we can't look to tribunals to do all that hard work for us. We have to do it in other spheres.
We have time for one brief question and a very brief response. Okay. It's almost 8 o'clock.
I'm asking David.
It's almost 8 o'clock, so I
yeah, El Danieli, I would like to comment from the reparative justice point of view, which is multidisciplinary, which answers some of what you just raised, yes, a court doesn't do everything to address what justice really means to victims, to societies, to communities, to the world. So I would like us to work more multidisciplinarily as a matter of course.
We have time for a question, not for a statement.
The question is, actually, no, it's a matter of sounding apologetic for the ICC, but I'm not an apologist for the ICC.
No, do you have a question?
Would you, I'll try to turn it into a question. Would you consider the victims' provisions in the theory of the ICC, not necessarily in the practice, as David pointed out, far more advanced than the ICTY even had a chance to reach?
A very brief response.
I think the answer is yes. So very clearly, yes. If judged solely in theory, in theory, yes. In practice, I'd like to look at an assessment. I think that there are real questions about that, and it's well designed, and you deserve credit, as does do a number of other people. I wish I could say something about domestic prosecutions, but then I will lose Ari's friendship forever. So,
okay. Diane, a last word, but only a very brief last word, if you would like.
No, I just want to, my last word will be to thank all of you, not only for coming here this evening, but for all of the contributions so many people in this room have made over decades, and I know will continue to make. So okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Again, the book is called Some Kind of Justice.